Every time he sees me, his eyes light up. I can almost hear his heart beat faster. He looks at me the same way he did when we first met. For him, it's love at first sight every day. For me, it's heartbreaking.
Loving someone who's living with dementia is not easy. For support, advice, or to make a donation, visit dementiasa.org.
You're listening to Vuka Online.
You are rocking with the best.
The Hope Makers Show, bringing hope to the world, one conversation at a time.
You are on the Hope Makers Show, and today I have Reverend Tony Krua. Am I pronouncing it correctly, Rev?
Oh, yes, Krua.
And I know, before I even go further, I know that as an African, I don't want to assume, because I always say to people, there's nothing like Africa. There's 54 countries, and obviously you can't make too many assumptions. But the one assumption that I want to throw to test is that your last name means something.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Krua, what does it mean? Krua means a conqueror. Someone who has conquered. Yes, a conqueror.
Oh, and, wow.
Yes. And Torley is actually a double name. It's Abi Torley. Abi, yeah, is the name of the creator of the universe in my language. Dan. Uh-huh. So I speak Dan and Abi Torley. So my name is Abi Torley, but because Torley actually means worthy of praises, but that cannot be given to anyone. So it's understood when you say Torley, you are referring to the Almighty Creator of the universe. So it's
Abi Torley. Yes. Yes. Wow. And that's interesting, because I think in Nigeria, just a little bit down from where you originally come from. Every child is Olu or Ola or Olu in terms of God and the presence of. So there's something there that's interesting about how we bring the name of the Creator into the names of the children in this instance. So that's kind of fascinating. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. So guys, as you know, the Hope Makers Show, the intention is really around exploring places, spaces, around how we can bring hope to the world, but maybe in a small way, by bringing hope to small community, by bringing hope to a big community. We're just exploring all the different places. So I met Tori at Vermont recently. I didn't know anything about him, and he had some very interesting stories to tell. And I think he has a very interesting plan, which is exciting me. So I keep saying, you know, where did I get the good fortune of meeting these people? Who are these people? But most importantly, who am I? So let's just kick it off with this question. What do you want the listeners to know about you?
Well, what I want the listeners to know about me is that I am a human being. And I was born in a village, and I currently live in Boston, Massachusetts. But what I've learned on my journey is that this world needs me, and I need the world. And that's one of the lessons I've learned from my journey. Yes.
Yeah. But how do you figure? I mean, I was having a conversation with a young man from Zambia recently, and while we're having a conversation, it got into this whole conversation about purpose and intention, and which sounds like that's kind of what you're talking about. But how do you know that the world needs you?
Oh, because I'm part of the world. I'm part of the world, and you know, I don't know how I was created, I don't know how I was assigned to the village that I was born in. I don't know why I was assigned to the family that I was born in, but those, I didn't have any role in the choices of my family lineage, my village, etc. But as I grow older and as I explore the world, I think the world needs me because the perspective I bring to the table is unique. And now I know that the, you know, where I am and what I bring with me, I bring my village. I left my village, but my village never left me. I bring my village. And the whole idea of community, do unto others as you will have others do unto you. It's the greatest need I see in the world today. Because in my village, it's easy for people to understand that there's no electricity in my village up to now from the days of Adam and Eve, if you believe that. But there's no electricity. There's no pipe on water. No one owns a car. There's no television. And if you take your cell phone, that's not going to work because we are so remote. We have further away removed. And so that's the type of place I live and I was brought up. But today, sitting down here in Boston, Massachusetts, I'm just two blocks from Harvard University, where my house is located. I see that the perspective that I have is so needed in the world of this mutuality. It's like in a lot of places.
Yes.
And so that's why I think the world needs me. And I think I need the world also.
Yeah, and I wanna explore this a little bit because and I think you've used the word village five times in the preceding part of your conversation. So I wanna explore the village conversation a little bit more. What always fascinates me about people that come to this show. I started tongue-in-cheek to asking, okay, who are these people and who am I? But the level of humility that you guys carry when you walk into the room where you don't tell people who you are, and then you have people that have 25% or less of accomplishments than you guys have, and they're going to, do you know who I am? So you haven't told us anything other than the fact that the world needs you and you grew up in the village but now you're in Boston, Massachusetts. So the city of tea. So when we come back, we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we get to know Tony Kruger a bit better since his arrival in the U.S., he has been an effective advocate for African refugees, gaining recognition from members of Congress, the cities of Boston and Baltimore, and an award during the 40th anniversary of the United States Peace Corps in Washington, D.C. And we shall speak a lot more about this very humble servant of God when we come back.
Highway Harley Davidson. There are no words.
Broadcasting worldwide online 24/7.
It's Vuga Online, your inspiration radio station.
Great. Welcome back. You are on Vuga Online Radio, and this is the Hope Makers Show, and we are talking hope. We are trying to bring hope to the world. I'm hoping that with some of the stories that you hear these fantastic people tell, it gives you a glimmer. I think for me, just listening to all of you guys and the journeys that you people have been through, I'm going like, wow, you know. In fact, I think the biggest thing for me, Tony, with this show is realizing how many people are there in the world that are doing real work. And they are not in the media. They are not in Hollywood and in lights and all of those things. But there's real work, and some of them are really struggling. But in that struggle, it's, as you use the words, they realize the world needs them, and they show up. So I want you to share a little bit in terms of your story. You obviously were not born in Baltimore, in Boston. So share a little bit, some of the highlights of your journey up until now.
Yes. So my dad, name is Reverend Monsi Krua. My mother passed away here in Boston. We came here as refugees, but in my village where I was born, my dad was not, he doesn't have formal education, but he's one of the most educated persons I've seen in life. I mean, he's so inspirational. Mm-hmm. Many years ago, the Republic of Liberia was founded by the United States government. Until today, this has been the biggest secret of the United States of America, that they actually were colonizers and created a colony. And so they created this colony called Liberia, Land of the Free, where it was created not by free slaves, but it was created by slave masters. And according to them, the purpose for the creation of Liberia, according to the second annual report of the American colonization, was to keep the slaves happy in slavery, to keep them committed and faithful to their servants. And to do that, they had to remove all the free people of color from the United States. So everything you're going to see will be slaves. Black men in slavery, and you cannot see a free person. That was the purpose for the United States government creating this place. So fast forward to Liberia, education was really a necessity. Missionaries came from the United States, and all the missionaries were always white people. They created these mission agencies to take the gospel to people in Africa, but without reaching people, black people in the United States, they had no black person, no person of color on their board of directors, no black person as a missionary, and no black person. They felt only white people could do these things. And when they came to my village, they wanted to preach the gospel that God wants to save us and send us to heaven. So my father and other people who were also Christians told them, hey, what's about education? We would like to have education. We want school in this village. And they said, oh, we don't have budget for education. It's quite expensive. So we cannot provide education for you. Hmm. And my father and his friends went to the government. And the government said, this place is too remote. We cannot provide education. They went to the company. And the company said, this place is outside of our concession area. We cannot provide education. So my dad and seven other friends came together to build the first school in this place. And that's where I started my education. It's called Zia Mission School. And from that place, coming up to where I sit today, there's been the perception in Africa that the United States is a place that believes in human rights. They believe in democracy. That's what we were told and taught.
Yes, yes.
But from my journey from that village, I went up to the fourth grade. I had to leave the village to go to another village. I had school higher than fourth grade. And I kept moving further and further away to go to high school. I had to go 150 miles away to go to the university. I had to go 200 miles. You know, I kept going and going and going. And what I realized on my journey is how important my village was to life. And up until the time I was able to get scholarship and get some education and then come back to my village. My journey to the United States began in way back in 1982. I came here working for a company, a computer company. I came to Boston, Massachusetts. But after 2 weeks, I said, this is not a place I want to live. I want to go back to my country to bring the technology back to my people. I went back and started my own company in my country. But fast forward, the war came to Liberia, and the war started in Boston, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Charles Taylor lived in Boston. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf lived in Boston, the former president. She was also part of the war. They came and they brought the war to Liberia, and I had to flee from Liberia to come back to the United States. And in my flight, what I realized was one of the biggest discoveries of my life. I always believed the United States was a place of human rights, of Christian values, and everything else. But during the war, just before I could come to the United States, I had a chance. I mean, I was sleeping in my house. I was asleep in my house, 4 o'clock in the morning. Seven guys armed with AK-47 came and broke into the house, came and put a gun on my head and said, you know, we're going to kill you because you are affiliated with Boston. They thought by coming to Boston earlier, I was part of this group from Boston that wanted to overthrow the government. And so they said, we're going to kill you. And by the grace of God, the right words came out of my mouth. And the words that came out was, I work for the United States government. If you kill me, they're going to come after you. Mm. Well, those words scared them, and then they made me a hostage. And eventually I was free, and I left the country to come to the United States. I went back to Liberia during the same war. I went back to Liberia after the airport has fallen to the rebels. There was no more airport. The president had been killed, assassinated. There was no more store. Everything had been looted. Only the United States Embassy was the only thing working in Liberia at the time.
Yes.
Everything was completely decimated. 250,000 people killed. I went back in service of the United States Embassy because the contract I had was with the United States Embassy. I went back and I was flown in by a United States Navy helicopter, and I landed at the embassy. I have an apartment in the embassy complex, and I'm working there. And while working there, I made this big discovery. Mm-hmm. Every day, people were coming. Embassy was open. People were coming for visa. Queuing up. People who had relatives in the United States wanted to flee to the United States. They queue up and come for visa. And everyone that was having a Liberian passport was denied visa. But when you were a Lebanese businessman, when you were an Indian businessman, when you were a white person from another place, they gave them visa to come to the United States. I didn't really pay too much attention. It was normal for Liberians to be denied visa. But one day, one woman came. And when they deny the Liberians visa, they get angry. They will insult the people. They will yell. And they will leave. Mm-hmm. But one day, one woman came. She had a little baby in her hand. Mm-hmm. And she came and applied for visa. They denied her visa, and she never raised her voice. She said, I need to go back to the States. I attended college in the United States. I went to graduate school in the United States. I got my relatives living in the United States. They have an apartment. I have money in the bank in the United States. And everything that came out of her mother was a document to back it up. I can't live here right now because the banks are closed. I got money, but we don't have food. There are no stores. And their visa officer looked her in the face and said, well, stop giving me more documents. Stop giving me more documents because we have sufficient documents. You're not going to America. If we give you visa, you can't go. We're not going to give you visa. If you go, you're not going to come back. She said, but I was there. I lived there. And she wouldn't raise her voice, but she wouldn't leave. It's the next person. And she just kept giving more pieces of paper to back up her claim. She has strong ties in the United States. She has strong ties in Liberia. Eventually, they called security to pull her out of the window. And that was the transition for me. Yeah. They pulled her and dragged her away from the window.
And I want to, I think that is a good space to pause it for a moment so that we can take some music because we are more music, more inspiration. But just listening to your story, and this kind of goes back to what we spoke about earlier when we kicked in and I spoke about whenever people talk about Africa and talk about Africans, it almost feels like Africa is the same place everywhere, right? And I'm listening to your story. I'm going like, my God, I've lived through apartheid, but what you've just described is a whole lot worse even because it's essentially war. But we don't call it war at that moment because it's acceptable behavior towards, I don't know, these people, which is for me, that's kind of like the sense that I'm getting out of this conversation, which is terrible. It tells me around how we live in a world that is so unequal in so many things. And the two lessons I'm already taking out of it is, one, guys, we have 54 countries on this continent, and Tony's story is definitely won't be mine, but there's also similarities in that story that we need to continuously pay attention to. And what's at the core of it is people treating people like they are not people.
Yes.
And I think when we come back, I want to explore a little bit about the work that you're doing in terms of refugees, because I think that was the start of the story, I think, as you say. Yeah. And what are some of the interesting challenges? But I'm also curious, I'm reading a little bit about something you wrote a couple of years ago. In Liberia and across Africa, most citizens are not economically independent, lack access to opportunities, and are considered the servants, while politicians are the masters.
Yes.
And continuously, I keep putting this, I keep repositioning myself and am I in this group? And the answer keeps going, yes and no, yes and no. So it's not a nice, clean division, but I'm interested in, from your story, from the people that you're working with and all of that, what's happening there and is there hope?
There is hope, yes.
You are on Vogue Online Radio and the Hope Makers Show, and we are talking to Tolly Kruger, and he is a pastor and an activist working across the U.S., working at least in Boston and Baltimore with immigrants, refugees, some of the interesting challenges, because this is a problem. Let's take some music, you guys. You can see there. I kind of want to go into this, but there is no better time to play this song than now, Liberian Girl.
Don't take credit. Unexpected coming from a bank, but just think about it. Using credit to finance a flashy lifestyle to show that you've arrived won't help you live better. What's new today is old tomorrow, except for the debt that you still have to pay. But do take credit to renovate your home, buy a more reliable car, or pay for your children's education. If that's your goal, then Capitec will help you realize your dreams. Because living better starts when you get credit for the right reasons.
More music, more inspiration. Vula Online.
You are on Vula Online Radio, and we are doing the Hope Makers Show, the show that brings, that tries at least to bring hope to the world, but hopefully it brings hope to your family, it brings hope to your spirit. And while sometimes we talk about really hard things, but we need to so that we can juxtapose that with, are we then hopeless? So, Tori, so you arrive, and then you were telling this story about this woman, and how it then kicked off your work. So, what is now the most important thing about your work? What are you wanting to achieve in general?
Well, the most important thing about my work today is exactly the same 30 years ago when I was sitting in the U.S. Embassy consulate, a woman pleading for her child that has money but couldn't buy food.
Yes.
Now, her venture to the United States, this woman wanted to live. Yes. She didn't want to die. And the people who had the power in the United States Embassy compound, they sentenced her to death by telling her, no way, no going to the United States for you. Even though if they are giving her a visa, there was no airport in the country that could take her out. She was going to have to brave the rebels and snappers and travel by foot to another country. But they denied her life. It was death sentence for this woman. Today, it's exactly the same thing. And what I'm just going to add this little piece. When they denied her visa and the security dragged her away from the window because she wouldn't move, she kept giving more evidences. She wouldn't move. They dragged her away. The baby started to scream when the security came. And that was the time I turned around to look at the face of this baby. And the baby, what I saw was shocking. A little child, malnourished, hasn't eaten in months. You can see the ribs. You can see the suckers in your eye. Been removed by a security guard. Mm. And at that point, I just asked the question, what's going on? And the counselor told me, oh, you don't know these people. Liberians think they are Americans, but since the war started, everyone wants to go to the United States, but we're not going to let them. I said, I thought this was governed by law. Didn't she prove? He said, oh, you don't know these people. Whether they prove or not. And then I said, well, I want to get a visa to go to America. He said, oh, no problem. You can get visa. I was a good black guy. I could get a visa because I was in there. And then I said, I'll bring my passport tomorrow. The next day I show up with a Liberian passport and he was shocked. Are you Liberian? Don't you have a green card already? I said, no, I don't have a green card. And then he said, well, I'm sorry, we cannot give you visa either because we have a classified cable here from Washington, D.C. that says, give visa to Lebanese, give visa to Indians, give visa to foreigners, but don't give visa to Liberians. Now, he said, if that's the truth, but if you don't like it, you cannot get visa now because of your nationality. This was a violation of the 14th Amendment, Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Right in the embassy complex. That document today remains classified. One of my goals in life is to make sure that document is declassified. Yes. But where I sit today in Boston, fast forward 30 years later, there are women and children living in Boston today as I speak to you. The city council of Boston just apologized for slavery a few days ago. A few days ago, we just celebrated Juneteenth. That celebrated 2.5 years after Black people were free, 1865. And yet in the same United States of America today, President Biden asked for $30 billion to help Ukraine. And the Congress responded by giving him $40 billion to help provide humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. But yet in the United States of America, there are women and children, Black women and children from Liberia, that have been given the same death sentence that was given to that woman at the United States Embassy. And so it's the same thing. It's do unto others as you have others do unto you.
Yes.
That golden rule is not being adhered to at all. Yes. Not in Liberia, not in the United States today, not during the time of slavery, and not at all, you know, even right now when there is no slavery. So it's crazy, but that's the thing. And we still have to see hope in that because everyone breathes the same air.
Yes.
You know, our heart is beating in us and we don't beat our hearts. So there's something above us in life that needs to give us that mutuality to allow people to live, to do unto others as we have others do unto us.
Yes, yes. And it sounds so dark, it sounds so cruel, it sounds so macabre in a country that is supposed to be representing hope for many of the people that are supposed to be living. And if you understand, as you are highlighted the history of Liberia in America, rationally, this shouldn't be an issue, right? So here's my question. With all the work that you're doing, is there hope?
There is hope. And the hope is in the hearts of the people who keep hope alive. There is hope. There is hope in the people who stand up, even though people are telling you to sit down. There is hope. Mm-hmm. And this is a country that calls itself a Christian country. And I'm going to even go ahead, you know, one of the things that I've done is to reach out to religious communities. Mm-hmm. People who are sending missionaries overseas to tell them, join me in advocacy for human life here in the United States, where you have four seasons, snow during the winter, heat during the summer. Can we have refugee women from Africa that have been brutally raped, tortured, that have escaped, that have survived torture and rape, that have arrived here in the United States to have a chance to work, to get permits to work? I'm not talking about free loading or anything, or to have access to humanitarian assistance. I've reached out to churches in the United States. And I got a letter from one of the Christian organizations that does work around the world, Samaritan Purse. Samaritan Purse wrote me a letter and said, Tolly, thank you very much for this letter and the suffering of these women and children in the snow. However, we are going to pray for them, take them to the throne of grace in heaven. But we will not get involved in politics to advocate for these refugees. Mm-hmm. That sentence was handed by the Samaritan Purse to these people. And so, you know, where the church has shut its eyes to the plight of poor people, where the government of the United States that is willing to aid and send billions of dollars to Ukraine, but not willing at all to give access to humanitarian assistance to refugees. And this is international law. They're not willing to do that. Mm-hmm. Where can we find hope? I can tell you where we find hope. We find hope in going consistently to confront the people. We go to them and keep telling them, this is the way, this is the right way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the grace of God, the right people will rise up. Like Miss Anderson in the City Hall of Boston, she was the one who spearheaded apology for slavery. And there are others who will come up and see and try to be the change. Mm-hmm. Because you know what? All of the slave masters are dead. Those who put in place these laws are dead. But what we have in Congress, children of slaves today, children of slaves, we have children of refugees, children of prisoners. Yes. All these people are now currently in the Congress, but they look at their political life. They look at their income, and they don't think about doing unto others as you have others do unto you. And so even in Congress, it becomes very difficult, but there is still hope. And that hope is going to be in the hearts of the people who are oppressed, still standing.
I wonder, Tony, I mean, I'm listening to you, right? And I'm hearing this. There's two pieces of noise that are happening. And one of the things that I continuously say, I've done a lot of work on values and human values and all of those things. And I realize that's actually where we need to go as humans to start connecting with our humanity. It's not this body, it's not this physical, but that's a different story. The point that I'm trying to make is whenever I've done this, I would find people saying what you just said, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I'm wondering if maybe that's not the problem. What if we started thinking about the platinum rule? Do unto others as they would want to be done to them.
I say amen to that. I say amen to that for two reasons. One of the key things that I'm seeking today is to have the United States to enact law on the municipal level, city ordinances state laws and federal laws that places people with lived experience on the board of directors of organizations that want to serve refugees. Today, the top refugee organizations in Europe and in the United States are headed, the board are headed by people who have absolutely no lived experience as refugees. So for them, it's a business. For them, it's a job. For them, it's fundraising. When you exclude people with lived experience, you cannot do unto them as they will have you to do. And so we need to make a demand, and I'm making that demand right now, as I said, here in Boston, because from the history of Boston, there has never been any regulation of nonprofit. Nonprofit organizations in America have tax exemption. They have tax exemption. They are also funded by the government, yet they are not regulated to be able to do unto people as the people desire. Because people from Harvard, people from Yale are leading these nonprofit organizations. And I can tell you, if you ask me to give you 10 PhDs who are refugees to in specific field who are also qualified to run any of these organizations, I can give you 25. But who's going to employ them? Nobody. These organizations will kick you out if they find out that you have lived experience, because they need the misery to continue making the profit. And so I agree with you 100%. Do unto others as they will desire. But to do that, those people have to be sitting on the table to make decisions. And if you don't have that, it's criminal.
Yes.
That is why, you see, when Liberia was started, Liberia was started because of 1776, the United States government had an American Declaration of Independence. It said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. That was the beginning of the United States. Black people and white people fought during the American Revolutionary War. But then 1790, March 26th, the Congress of the United States, dominated by slave traders, came up with a new law, which was the first apartheid law in the whole world. Only white people will be allowed to be citizens of the United States. And when that law was passed, it was signed by George Washington, who owned hundreds of slaves. Most of the first 10 presidents of the United States were all slaveholders. And so they had to find a way to remove all of the free blacks, all of the Americans who happened to be black, all of the Americans who happened to be mixed race. They had to be removed. And they passed a new law. March 3, 1819 was the law of colonization. It provided $100,000 to establishing a colony in Africa. It authorized the United States Navy, the force of the United States Navy, to remove free blacks from the United States and settle them in Liberia. And when they came to Liberia, they also became colonizers. The free blacks from the United States colonized the indigenous people so that the indigenous people could not be citizens of Liberia. For more than 100 years, Africans could not be citizens of Liberia.
But I have to interrupt you here, right? Because we don't have a lot of time from a history, and I think maybe that's probably one of the things that needs to come out of this conversation, right? To say perhaps some of these things happen based on a lot of ignorance, with people not necessarily understanding how things work and how we, I mean, there's always this question that says, how did we get here? Right. But remember I said there's two noises, now it's three. of noise that's sitting in my head. You mentioned Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf at some point, right? And for me, growing up here, growing up on the continent, she was this light of hope for Liberia, because for as long as I had known the history of Liberia, it was exactly some of the stuff that you mentioned. So the noise in my head says
do you have access, and can she do something? That's one. But that's a sub question of the big question that I'm asking, that I'm putting now the head of this person that's sitting at an immigration office with a MAGA head saying, why can't Africa solve itself? Why do you people have to come here?
Yes.
What's your response?
Well, why do we have to come here? In the case of Liberians, this nation was built by people of color. It was built on the labor of people of color. It was built on the land of Native Americans. Mm. If anyone belongs here, we do. And yes, the people were removed from here by law. And so those harm are still ongoing, need to be mitigated. We belong here. That's the first thing. Second thing is, you mentioned Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Can she do something? Mm. I personally approached Lima Bowie, who is also a Nobel laureate from Liberia. Yeah. And I presented her with photograph of women in Liberian women in the United States, and ask her personally to do something. She has done absolutely, I've written and I've gotten tired. I've heard nothing from her. Mm. President Sirleaf, I have presented the same issue to her when she was president. Mm. And I can tell you, you know, this business of the nonprofit sector, people trying to find ways to raise money for causes that they like, etc., and not having the people themselves to decide what it is that they want, that is a big problem. And President Sirleaf has, if President Sirleaf had put her mouth and her voice to this, I don't think, with her prestige, I don't think we'll still have in the United States in 2022 women with children that don't have permits to work. When the Constitution of Liberia, Article 1 of the 1824 Constitution of Liberia says, all persons born in Liberia are entitled to all privileges enjoyed by American citizens. And that is why right now we are starting a petition, the petition called the Ben Swan Petition, named after Representative Ben Swan from Springfield, that we are pushing for visa waiver for Liberians to have access to quality education, employment and business opportunity in the United States without visa. Because if President Biden, for example, as I speak to you, President Biden is sending billions of dollars over to Ukraine in the name of fighting for democracy. Mm. Why Liberian refugees cannot work in the United States? I mean, it's crazy. President Biden needs to step up. And if you cannot defend human rights at home, yeah, you are not defending human rights abroad, because charity begins at home.
You are on Vuka Online Radio and the Hope Makers Show. And I think this is a very interesting conversation, Tony, because I think many times listening to a lot of the stories, to many of the stories that we've had, there seems to be a lot of transition to a space of now this has shifted, this has changed. But what I'm hearing from you is almost a call, a cry for help, and a call for collective support, a call for joint advocacy of sorts that says there is a community of people that are looking for hope. Can we think about what could be those creative small but impactful ways that would essentially change the situation? Because I refuse to believe that the situation is as hopeless, it will remain, can remain as hopeless as it sounds. And I think the second thing, who said this, by the way? He said slaves didn't leave Africa to America. People left Africa to America. And if we keep that in mind, what kind of light can shine in our hearts when we start thinking about how these are not the labels, these are not slaves, these are not children of slaves, these are people. So if we think about it that way, what light does it shine in the hearts of the listeners and whoever it is that's interested in this? We need to take a quick break and then we need to come back and, ooh, I need to sneeze. So we'll be back for this.
The Africa Center for Work-Based Learning is a professional development center for professionals who aim to improve their professional standing. This means that the learning programs we run are more than just academic programs. They are work-based programs that focus on leveraging your current experience as a professional to build your overall profile. A year down the line, the Africa Center for Work-Based Learning is developing into a preferred center for professional development in Pretoria, with 8 professional development faculties including accounting, teaching, entrepreneurship, as well as IT and many more. For more information, go to acwbl.org or dial +27 12 751 7608. The Africa Center for Work-Based Learning, where work is learning.
Broadcasting worldwide online 24/7.
It's Vuga Online, your inspiration radio station.
You are on Vuga Online Radio, and we are on the Hope Show, Hope Makers Show, and we're trying to make hope in the world. As much as we can. I don't know why I have a lot of sneeze now in my nose, but it's very cold here, Tori. This morning it actually was snowing a little bit, and it's 10 degrees Celsius now, wow. where I'm sitting as I am talking to you. So I want to bring this back personal a little bit, right? I used the word hopeless just before we took a break. Are you hopeless?
Oh, no, I'm not hopeless at all. I'm energized by the plight of these people when I see. Because you see, the thing is, I have children. And one of the problems we have in the world is that people think that there needs to be some Mandela to take care of this problem. The attorney general has to take care of this. The police has to take care of this problem. That's what people think. No. Yeah.
Because that's how I'm thinking. I'm thinking, where is Judge Weir on this thing? But yeah, carry on.
Judge Weir. Okay, yeah, that's the thing. So Judge Weir, I actually hand deliver by DHL. I have a receipt of what I'm telling you, documented, presented to Judge Weir. His Excellency, Mr. McCarthy, the current United States Ambassador to Liberia, I hand deliver. May last year, I hand deliver the plight of these Liberians to him.
Yeah, but, you know, I distracted you. I think you were talking about your hopelessness, and are you hopeless? So sorry, my bad.
So I have hope because I myself, as a human being, still breathing, where I don't control my breath. When I go to sleep, I'm not there, you know, making myself to breathe. It goes automatically. When my heart beats, I'm not there to press it down for it to beat. The life that is in me gives me hope, and that life I bring to the space wherever I go. And I don't really care when I bring it to George Weah and he tosses it on the side. That's okay. I'm still having life. I'm still moving forward. I bring it to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She tosses it on the side. I bring it to Ambassador McCarthy. These people need to act, but they are not acting. And so I still move forward and try to get other people to join because I have children. I have 2 children. And I will not like what is going on with other people's children to happen to my children. But as long as I ignore the plight of these people, I'm creating a monster for myself and my children and generations in the future. So for example, right now I'm pushing for peace in Ukraine. I want peace in Ukraine, not sending billions of dollars worth of military hardware to keep fighting for victory for Ukraine or for Russia. Right. We need peace in Ukraine. If right. the investment we have in war can be put into peace, if the investment we have for our children can be put into the children of other people, we will have a better world. But if I just focus on my children and focus on only my ideas and my job and my nonprofit and my funding, you know, we have a situation where the people that we are looking up to as heroes, you know, they're not going to be able to help the cause. So everyone is a hero. Everyone who has life is able to serve. So I don't want people to think this thing has to be up to the guy in Boston. You, wherever you are, you could be in South Africa and be part of this fight as well. You could be in, you know, any place around the world. As long as you have life, we have hope together. And that's how I want to look at it.
No, I like that. I like the idea around personal responsibility and accountability as a way of creating hope. And it has come out quite a lot also on the show to say, once you elevate yourself out of the space of this is happening to me into a space of I'm part of the experience, how do I respond to the experience? It starts creating something interesting. What else, do you have any, I mean, you are also a pastor of the church. So sometimes there's this idea that does religion help? Does religion give people hope? I'm kind of curious. You are the only reverend I've spoken to so far.
I think it's more about life, because there are so many different religions in the world today. There are so many religions in the world, and people look at religion, they look at God. But for me, being a Christian, I take consolation in the fact as what the Bible says. How can you love God whom you have never seen and hate human beings who you see? God is love. And anyone who loves God loves people, because people are made in the image of God. You know, I've spoken everywhere about the plight of refugees, and people, once I get through speaking, people will start telling me, oh, you have to go to this congressman, or you need to go to Biden. No, I need you. I don't need Biden. I'm speaking to you right now. When I first came to the United States, I would tell people about the plight of refugees, and instantly they would tell me, man, you need to come and speak to our youth group. They need to know that they are privileged. I say, hey, shut up. I'm not here to talk about your youth group. I have brought a problem, and I want you to do something about the problem I'm bringing to you. Don't remove my problem and put it on the side and bring your issue. Everybody has to bring their solution to the fore. And that's what I believe in. I believe that all of us can do something if we stop thinking that the solution to this thing that has been brought to our attention today lies with Wea or Salif or someone out there. I'm nobody. But I'm bringing my life into the picture. I'm bringing my life to give life to others. So that is what I think about God Almighty, who created the entire universe, is love. And if you love God, whom you have never seen, you are going to care for human beings, because human beings were made in the image of God.
There you go. I mean, how much more do you need than that, right? So and I have another question, but I'm going to come back to it. We continuously, we started when we talked about the village. And I'm continuously curious about the village. I was actually reflecting when we were in Vermont that I'm a city boy.
Are you scared of that bear when it came out of the woods?
I am suburban, so I kind of was in America. I was feeling very strange being in the village, within the village vibes,
when in fact I'm a city boy, you know. But I had a great grandmother. I had a really amazing grandmother who was able to teach a couple of values. But one of the things I wonder about, Tolly, is what are the lessons we can learn from the village that can bear fruit, perhaps, for this issue? What are we learning? What could we be learning? What could we learn from the village that can help us with this thing that we're talking about?
Well, one of the things I think we can learn from the village is mutuality, community. You know, in the village, people care for one another. People, when you bring an issue to a person in the village, they don't try to put it up to some politician or something. It's not always what can someone else do, but what can I do to help? And so that idea in the village, where we rely on the sun to shine, we rely on the rain, and then we grow crops, and we depend on each other, we help one another. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is the key. Because when people think, I don't need... Look, I can tell you, a lot of these people that I've gone to help these people who they consider nobody, if they look at me as somebody that can help their cause, if George Weah thinks that I can help his cause to win the next election, he's going to try to help. He's going to try to pay attention to the issues I bring to him. If Ellen Sirleaf or all of these, even Joe Biden today, if Joe Biden really believes that I can help the Democrats in the election that's coming up in the midterm election, and I tell him, Joe, can we help these refugees? He's going to jump up right away and say, yes, let's do that. But you see, the common humanity has been sort of erased, and people don't see that. When you see a person standing in front of you, you don't see yourself. You don't see God. You don't see how this person standing in front of you could be you tomorrow. Yeah. But in the village, that mutuality, you help people. If I go, there are no hotels in my village. There are no prisons in my village. Yes. If you come to the village, you're going to find a place to sleep. Yes. And people come from other places. When it gets dark, they are walking long distance. They get dark. They always find a place to sleep. They always find food to eat. When people say hi, they offer you food all the time. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, where I live right now in Boston, everybody depends on their paycheck. And if they don't have paycheck, they depend on the welfare system. But if you don't have social security number, if you are not having a green card or United States citizenship, you are completely excluded. One of the things that I've asked for is not just to make these nonprofit organizations to be representative of the people they serve. I'm also calling on the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to create a system for indigent, for people who are not part of the system, to get a chance to live. The United States cannot go around the world, you know, donating money to humanitarian causes around the world when people are dying right here. Churches don't pay attention. You know, you don't do that. You shouldn't be doing that. Yeah. But that's why it's been done. Because people don't see the humanity. They look at you and they don't see the image of God in you.
And you know, as I said, I didn't grow up in the village. And I continuously work on this work around having to dismantle stereotypes a little bit about some of these things. I grew up in the township. And where I grew up, what you've just described is in many ways, still a way of life. When I'm gone, I don't worry so much about who's going to take care of my house. Mm-hmm. My neighbors, when people were breaking into my house, and this is like a city. It's like pretty much like Bronx, pretty much like, I don't know, any city, in any suburban area in the US. This is essentially how we are, which says it's possible. When I am hungry, or I don't have electricity, I don't worry so much about where am I going to get electricity. I can deal with my problem with money and permanently when I need to. But I'm not going to sleep hungry because I'm going to stand over the fence. And when I do, something is going to come out of the gate, a bowl, a dish, whatever, to come and feed the family. And then we sort it out tomorrow. That's how we are here. So that's why at the beginning when I started, I said, it is actually quite fascinating listening to the paradox and the polarities of how there's hope around how the people are shifting, but we probably need to hear a lot more of these stories of people being people. But the last thing I wanted to say, just connecting back to the lessons of the village, the people that demonstrate the behavior you just described, that look down on people, that close their doors on people, that minimize and sometimes demonize people, in my language, they're called things, not even animals. They are things. So in isiZulu language, we have a word called Ubuntu, mm-hmm. Which you probably would have heard about, meaning humanity, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in that humanity, you are human if you demonstrate the behaviors we've just described, yeah, from the village. That's what makes you human. That's it. Race, age, gender, language doesn't matter. It doesn't say anything. You demonstrate that behavior. If you don't, the grandmothers where I come from call you Isluan, a thing. And that is the punishment that even today, if I say to you, Isluan, you are a thing, it is the biggest insult. Because of the value of how we value that humanity. And I'm wishing that as I'm saying this, somebody is listening and asking, how can I be human?
And how can I transition from being a thing to a human?
and be able to do that? Because that's really all we are, right? I don't think it has anything to do with the village. I don't think it has anything to do with the suburb. It's in all of us. Yes. And what will give me hope is to see more of that showing up. So, Tony, what do you need? What a rallying cry. I'm hearing here that you probably also need money. So maybe we probably need to find someone to create some GoFundMe account or something like that. But I know money speaks. But what do you need as a last word? What do you need to support you on this program?
I need you. I need everyone who's listening to realize that we all embody the solution that we seek. That's the humanity. I need your humanity to shine on what I'm doing. Let me just tell you one thing. Mm. I live in Boston now for almost 30 years. I just started working like 2 weeks ago. Mm. I just started working the first job, working 2 days a week. Mm. This business of human suffering has weighed so much on me that I decided that's work in itself. Mm. I'm not going to go to do something else. I'm going to do this work, and God is going to take care of me. In the book of Luke, chapter 9, verse 3, when Jesus sent out 12 disciples to proclaim the good news, to heal the sick, to raise the dead, to feed the hungry, he said, don't take money with you. Don't take extra coat. Just go and I'll provide for you. And that is what has happened to me. The house that I'm sitting in right now, I'm going to take pictures of it and send it to you. Mm. I won this house through a lottery. It's just a few blocks from Harvard. I can't even afford it. The car that I drive right now, I won that car through a raffle. I cannot even afford that car. Yeah. But people are thinking that I have to work to get everything and I got to step on everybody, pull them down, and I don't need to care for these people. these are children of God. In on Judgment Day, there's one thing. It's not your degree or your church or your religion that's going to count. It's what you did for the least of these. I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was thirsty and you gave me water to drink. These common things that people can do are the things that do sustain. So for me right now, one of the things that I need is people to stand up and say, I want to walk with you.
Yeah.
I want to be there with you. And you can be anywhere. The website is freeliberia.org, freeliberia.org. You can join by going there to just put your name and your number to where it says join me. And you can be part of this journey.
Yes.
I mean, there's a donation place that you can also make a donation. Yeah. But the Bible says where your treasures are, there will your heart be also. So everybody can get involved in this plight, because it's not just about that woman and the 15-year-old girl that have been living here in snow and still living. Look, one last thing I have to say. Recently, we marked 1 million dead people in the United States from COVID. 1 million dead. The superpower of the world clocked 1 million dead people in the United States, because a lot of people living in crowded situations, people who cannot work, people who don't have health insurance, people, and these people living in America succumbed to the COVID virus. 1 million dead people in America. To me, when I look at that, I said it's unnecessary. If we were our neighbor's keepers, if we help people to get a job, if we help people to get permits to work, we won't have the situation of all these people dying. Now, all of them are dead now, and then we'll come and say, what are we going to do next?
Yeah.
So we need to help each other. And I'm calling on you. If you are listening to me, I want you to be part of this journey, because it's not going to last forever. It's going to come to an end. These people will be free. We will have a chance to change the laws and we'll have a better world. But it's going to take you. It's not going to take President George Weah or President Biden or President Putin or President Xi. It's you who can make this new hope to be alive in the world.
Usually when I close the show, I usually ask that question, what the world needs now is. But I think you've answered it. What the world needs now is you, who is listening right now. Since his arrival in America, Torley has been an effective advocate for African refugees, for gaining recognition from members of Congress, the cities of Boston and Baltimore, an award-winning advocate, 40th anniversary of the United States Peace Corps in Washington. You, my sir, are a representation of the Spirit of God on earth, and I wish you lots of luck. I wish you lots of progress. Actually, that's what I should be saying. Lots of progress on this work that you are doing, which is a calling.
Yes, I want prayers. I want people to pray and stand with me, not like the Samaritan prayer that says we will pray to God, but we're not going to advocate for these people. I want people to actually stand with me in prayer, and together, we can make the dreams of these refugees to become a reality. They are human beings made in the image of God, and nobody who breathes, nobody whose heart is beating need to ignore anyone and say, you don't belong here, because we all belong on this earth.
Absolutely. We usually close the show with a song. What song can I play for you?
Lift Every Voice and Sing. That's my favorite song. Lift Every Voice.
There you go. It is actually one of my favorite. When I was growing up, I used to be a soprano, so I used to like the Melba Moore version that came out very commercial, and I would sing in that soprano. But now I can't do any soprano anymore.
Why not?
Because it's gone. You use it. You don't use it. You lose it. I mean, you had me pretend to sing the other days.
You did a good job, by the way. You impressed me a lot.
Totally. Thank you so much, man. Thank you for the conversation and for the passion and everything. And to you, the listener at home, we are way out of time, and I leave you with the regular way to remember: hope is the seed of data in our heads that tells us it will be all right. if we nurture it. So just breathe. And I will see you, God willing, next week as we try to bring hope into the world. For now, ciao.